This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Today we're going to think about summer and digging around in the dirt looking for stuff that is important to the ancient history of where we live, and we're going to talk about that with Clint Boyd. He is the state paleontologist for the North Dakota Geological Survey. It's a division of the Department of Mineral Resources, and he joins us today to talk about fossils. Clint, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
We've had you on before, and I suspect I've asked you this question, but for our listeners, how would you describe your job as state paleontologist?
Well, my job is to go out across the state and identify where we have fossils present in North Dakota, and then make sure that we preserve and protect as many of those fossils for today's North Dakotans and for future generations as possible.
And how do you do that? I mean, you must know where a good place to go would be, don't you? Or don't you?
Well, in some cases, we do have known sites that we go back to time and time and again that produce good quality fossils, but a lot of it is just identifying areas where the right rock should be present, but they haven't been searched, at least not recently, and then doing a lot of walking surveys and covering a lot of ground and looking for new exposure of fossils. And it can be, you know, the change of one rainstorm. You walk over a surface and there's nothing there. We get a good rain, you go back, and suddenly something new and beautiful is coming out. So it's a constant process that'll never be finished.
Do a lot of states have state paleontologists, or is this somewhat unique?
North Dakota is a bit unique. Most states do have, you know, paleontologists somewhere in the state, but oftentimes they work directly at private museums or for universities. North Dakota is one of the only states that has a state paleontology program. The others that I'm aware of, New York has a state paleontologist, Utah, the Utah Geological Survey has a state paleo team, but there's not very many states like North Dakota. And I think North Dakotans should take pride in the fact that North Dakota has recognized the importance of this resource and for preserving it for North Dakotans for the future.
Why are you part of the Department of Mineral Resources?
So one arm of the Department of Mineral Resources is the North Dakota Geological Survey. And so that's the side that I work for, is the Geological Survey. And that covers everything from studying the subsurface of North Dakota, the layers of rock down below where all the oil and gas is coming from, studying the surface of North Dakota, mapping out where different rocks are present, and looking at, say, landslides and other geologic hazards like that. And paleontology then falls in with that, since the fossils come out of the rocks, and since the scope of the geological survey is to study the rocks, we get put into that category.
Now, aren't fossils everywhere? Is North Dakota special in terms of the type or the number of fossils?
Well, fossils are present mostly in what we refer to as sedimentary rocks, so rocks that have been deposited through processes like rivers and streams, the ocean bottom, places like that. Alternatively, where you've got, say, granite and other rocks that formed, you know, directly from molten rock, like in mountain ranges, those rocks very, very rarely, if ever, will have fossils in them. So to find fossils, you have to have these sedimentary rocks like sandstone and mudstone and shale and limestone. And North Dakota is a little bit unique in that the entire surface of North Dakota is all sedimentary rocks. We don't have any of the other types of rocks, what we call igneous rocks, present in North Dakota. And so that means anywhere in North Dakota, you could find fossils. And then you add to that the fact that we have, especially in the western half of the state, really good exposures of bare rock in areas, especially like at Theodore Roosevelt National Park. And those factors together just make North Dakota a really great place to look for fossils.
Are some types of soils, and I'm thinking about the Red River Valley with its heavy clay deposit, ancient Lake Agassiz, are we more or less likely to have significant fossil finds here?
A little bit less likely. You can still find Pleistocene age fossils, so fossils from the Ice Age and a little bit more recently, so especially mammoth and bison fossils in those areas, but they're not as frequently, they're not as dense, and so it takes a lot more searching. But along some of those bigger rivers that run through the eastern part of the state, the rivers themselves cut down through those ice age sediments and they get to the older rocks underneath. And so one really great place in the eastern part of the state to look for older fossils, say the age of the dinosaurs, is right along the banks of the larger rivers where the river is cut down. And for example, our dig that we do up in the Pemina Gorge in the northeast corner of the state, that's why those fossils are exposed there, is from the Pemina River cutting down through, washing that ice age rock away and getting to the older rocks underneath.
So are you finding ancient fossils of stuff that used to swim or walk on land at the Pemina Gorge?
At the Pemina Gorge, we find the animals that lived in the ocean at the time of the dinosaurs. At this time, we don't know of any dinosaurs that were aquatic that lived in the water. So there's not really much chance of finding dinosaurs themselves up at the Pemina Gorge, unless we have a rare case where, say, an animal died on the beach and then bloated up and floated out to sea and then sank down, which can be found very rarely, but has not been found in North Dakota. Otherwise, we're looking at a lot of fish, and then large predators called mosasaurs are our biggest fossils we find up there. And they're more closely related to modern lizards like Komodo dragons than they are dinosaurs, but they are impressive animals.
Clint Boyd is the state paleontologist. We're talking about the fossil record in North Dakota and about upcoming fossil digs this summer, which we'll get into in a moment. But what does the fossil record, Clint, say about changes to North Dakota's climate and landscape?
Well, we have a really good record on the surface in North Dakota from just before the end of the age of dinosaurs, say about 68, 67 million years ago, up until the end of what's called the Oligocene, which is about 30 million years ago. And what we see in North Dakota during that time, when the dinosaurs around, we're looking at an environment that's a lot like, say, modern southern Louisiana, that coastal bayou type environment, very hot, very humid. And as we move through time, it gets even warmer after the dinosaurs go extinct and we go into a very extensive swamp environment here in North Dakota. But then about 34 million years ago, it starts to get cooler and drier and we lose those swamps and we transition into more of an open woodland and then into kind of like a savanna environment like you would see in parts of Africa today, on our way to eventually developing into the grasslands that we see today. Unfortunately, we lose that record from about 30 million years ago up until a few tens of thousands of years ago, because all of that rock that would have been there was eroded away by the glaciers during the Ice Age. So we don't have that record, but the 67 million to 30 million year record is pretty clear and shows some interesting trends.
Well, the state famously has a fossil fuel deposit or two. Do researchers study drilling cores for fossils? Do you actually look at that kind of stuff?
I myself don't, but yes, that is an area of study. And in fact, there has been studies done on, there's a repository up at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks, which is also run by the North Dakota Geological Survey, where every well that gets drilled in North Dakota has to put parts of their core into that record to be saved and studied for the future. And paleontologists, especially those that study what are called invertebrates, so like clams and snails and corals and things like that, have studied those cores and have identified completely new species from those rocks that have never been seen before. So even something as kind of small in scale, because you're only talking about a core that's a few inches in diameter, but that's enough to get fossils back that can give us a really great insight into past environments of rocks that we don't have on the surface anywhere.
And it's kind of a reminder that we drive around burning up dinosaurs and old plants, I guess. The state has lignite coal mines, and they've been dug pretty deeply into the earth. Of course, there are anthracite and bituminous mines that go much deeper. Do fossils show up in that kind of environment? I know lignite's a lot wetter, but do you find fossils in that environment?
You can find fossils associated with those environments, especially a lot of the invertebrates, like I was talking about, clams and snails and things like that. And you can find vertebrate fossils as well. Those are deposited in that hot, humid, swampy environment. And so you can run into things like crocodiles and turtles and fish and
Wow.
animals like that when you're doing that work. So it's a possibility.
How important is the summer fossil dig?
You know, one of our main missions is educational outreach. So from our point of view, it doesn't do us that much good to save and protect these fossils if then they get hidden away and nobody in North Dakota ever sees or learns from them. And so we kind of see it as our secondary purpose beyond finding and saving these fossils is to educate the public about them. And there's no better way to educate the public about fossils than to take them out with us and show them exactly the process of how they're found, how they're collected, how we clean them up, and then eventually what happens to them is in terms of when they go on display, so that people can understand more about a fossil than just seeing it in the museum in its final form and see how it gets from the ground to there. And the other benefit of the Fossil Digs program is that we have three paleontologists on staff here with the Geological Survey, and you know, three sets of hands and three sets of eyes can only do so much work when you have to cover an entire state. And so what the public fossil digs allow us to do is then to take out, you know, roughly a dozen extra people per day and get more work done and more fossils found than we could ever do on our own. So I know we understand that this is a very popular thing for people to do, you know, kind of as a recreational thing, but at the same time, they are helping us do critical work that otherwise would be very difficult for us to complete at the same scale.
What can you tell us about this summer's fossil dig schedule?
So this summer, we will be returning to three of our main dig sites. We'll start off the summer in June, going back out to Medora and working in Paleocene rocks that are from just after the dinosaurs go extinct. And so that's during that hot, humid, swampy time where we'll be digging a site that is an old pond bottom. And so we have lots of crocodiles, crocodile-like animals called champsosaurs. They're kind of like a crocodile, but they don't have the bony armor and they have this really long, narrow snout. So they're obligate fish eaters. There's lots of fish at that site and turtles as well as lots of clams in the bottom of that pond. And so it's a really dense site. And what's nice about it is that most of the fossils are in like a 2-inch thick layer. And so we know exactly where to dig. We go right down to that layer and then the people focus on that exact layer and that's where the fossils are at. So it's very easy to hone in on where you should be digging. When we move to July, we'll move to our second site, which is just south of the Bismarck-Mandan area along the Missouri River Bluffs. And there we will be digging in the age of the dinosaurs, looking mostly for dinosaur fossils and the other animals that lived with them. And we'll do that for the entire month of July. That's our longest and most popular dig. We'll be looking for dinosaurs like Triceratops, the three-horned dinosaur, and of course the big predatory dinosaur, Tyrannosaurus rex, is always the popular one. And then we'll finish up the season in August. We'll move up to the Pembina Gorge, still at the age of the dinosaurs, but a little bit older. Instead of about 67 million years old in the Bismarck area dig, we'll be looking more at like 80 million years old. And instead of looking for the animals that lived on land, we'll be digging those sea creatures, the mosasaurs, hopefully the plesiosaurs, the big long-necked marine reptiles, and lots of fish and other animals that lived in the ocean at the same time as the dinosaurs. So that'll be our span for this summer.
Who can take part? Is this a family thing? Can you bring the kids, or what are you looking for?
We'd like to say it's open to everybody, but there are a few limitations just based on our past experience of how well family groups do on these digs. So we do have specific family days, days that are set aside just for families to participate. But there is a limit of children have to be at least 10 years old to participate on those digs. And we've come to that age just on past experience of, on average, how old the kids have to be in order to work safely. You know, we are using some sharp tools, some awls and things like that. And so 10 is the minimum age to participate in those family digs. And those family digs are also half-day digs because those younger individuals, they get out there in that sun and as excited as they are and as happy as they are to be there, they wear down relatively quickly. And so we split the day in half, which then allows us to get twice as many people out there. But for our full-day digs, once kids reach the age of 15, you know, as long as they're accompanied by an adult or guardian, they can be there for the full day. and participate in everything that we do. So that's kind of our two breakdowns. The family days tend to be on the weekends, and then the full days for 15 and up tend to be the weekdays.
Clint Boyd is the state paleontologist for the North Dakota Geological Survey, a division of the Department of Mineral Resources. You can find out lots of information at dmr.nd.gov, and then there's a menu on the left side of that homepage that has paleontology there, and you can find out about the summer dig schedule and other things. Do you tell people where they're going to be digging, or is this sort of a secret that day?
We don't give out a map like with a point on it, but it's pretty well known where we're digging at our sites. We go back to the same exact spot at these three digs every year, so they're kind of a known location, which can cause some issues. We have had some issues in the past of people sneaking out to those sites when the digs aren't going on, and sometimes people in the know catch them and inform them that they shouldn't be there. And other times we do have some damage at some of the sites, but that's, kind of one of the trade-offs of doing this type of program. And, we have to decide whether the educational component is worth that risk. And from what we've seen, it is worth that risk.
Up on your website, I discovered that there is a state law that is about 30 years old that protects fossil discoveries on public lands. What kind of protection is that? And do you also engage private landowners in, checking out their stuff, their land?
Laws for fossils vary depending on what type of land people are looking at working on. If it's federally managed land, like, say, National Park Service or Forest Service, you can't collect most fossils on those lands, or in the case of the Park Service, any fossils on those lands without a permit from the federal government. And that includes us. We have to get permits as well if we do any work out there. State lands is similar, where you have to have a permit, and those fossils have to be going to a institution like a museum or a university to be saved for future generations. They can't just go home with people. And that covers all state-owned lands, so, like state trust lands or state parks and things like that. But when it comes to private land, there are no regulations on what happens to fossils off of private lands. Those private landowners who own the surface rights, fossil ownership goes with surface rights. And anyone who owns the surface rights on land, they own the fossils as well, and they can do whatever they want with them. They can collect them for themselves and keep them for themselves, display them at home. They can partner with a commercial collector who will collect the fossils and put them up for sale and then share the profits with the landowner. Or they can partner with our office and have their fossils go to the state fossil collection and be put on display and saved for future generations. Or in some cases, people are just completely uninterested and leave them to sit there and rot and weather away. And as sad as that can be, that's their right as well. So, and that's an important thing to recognize, is that we do a lot of work here at the Geological Survey with private landowners. In fact, our dig in the Bismarck area, that is done on private land that we have a really great partnership with a private landowner. And they just love having people come out and getting to interact with the people and seeing the great discoveries, but have no interest in keeping the fossils themselves. And so it's a good arrangement. But I think that's an important thing for everyone to remember, is that the fossils on private land, those are the property of the private landowners, and that's something that, we all have to respect.
The North Dakota State Fossil Collection is at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. If you've been to the Heritage Center, lots of people have, you've seen some very impressive fossil displays. But I'm assuming, Clint, that that's the tip of the iceberg, that the collection is probably bigger than what you can put on display.
Yeah, that's a very, very small percentage of the fossils that we have in total in the collection make it on display. Most of our best fossils are on display here at the Heritage Center, but we do have, I think we're at 24 other exhibits across the state in other small museums or visitor centers and places like that, that we're very excited to get those fossils back to the local communities. But the vast majority of the fossils that we collect are in our collections facility here in Bismarck, in the basement of the Heritage Center. And when people hear that, sometimes they get a little dissatisfied with that, thinking that we're hiding away most of our fossils where people can't see them. But the reason that most of those fossils aren't on display is because most of those fossils aren't really kind of display quality. They're the more fragmentary fossils, or the ones that are so fragile that we couldn't actually put them up on display without fear of them falling apart. And so in almost every case, if we have a fossil that is interesting enough that people would want to see it and is stable enough to be on display, we have it on display somewhere in the state. And so while most of our fossils are in the basement, most of the fossils that the people would want to see are on display somewhere.
Is the North Dakota fossil collection of interest to scientists outside of our state? Do we have pieces that are really unique or of special interest?
We do. We have a lot of researchers that come to the state to work on North Dakota's fossils. A couple of points that really make North Dakota unique. North Dakota is one of the best states to study the extinction of the dinosaurs because we have that KPG boundary that formed from the asteroid impact that hit the Yucatan Peninsula that contributed to the death of the dinosaurs, really well preserved here in North Dakota. So researchers come from all over the world to look at the fossils that are present below that layer, to study the layer itself, and then look at the fossils that are found above the layer right after the extinction of the dinosaurs in order to determine what species survived, and then also how quickly animals diversified again and took over those open roles that were left by the extinction event. And so that's one of our good study areas. And then also our mammal fossils, especially that we have in North Dakota from after the age of the dinosaurs, from the Paleocene running from 65 to 50-ish million years ago, and then another good record in the Oligocene about 33 to 30 million years ago. We have really unique deposits here that are really extensive, especially in terms of the Paleocene. And so it's another set of deposits that people come from all over to look at. And in fact, right now we're working with the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C., and also with researchers in California on a new animal that comes from about 32 million years ago. We have an almost full skeleton of this little mammal that I don't want to say too much about because I think it's going to be really exciting when it comes out. But it's an animal that's never been seen before, and it's really critical for understanding the evolution of early dogs and bears and related animals in North Dakota. So North Dakota, even with all the work that's been done here, continues to produce just amazing fossils that interest people from across the world.
So there are still holes in the state's, or for that matter, the world's fossil record, and discoveries are out there to be made, I take it.
Yep, and I think another important thing to note is a lot of the important discoveries that have been made in North Dakota, you know, for the past decade or so have come on these fossil digs. Some people ask whether we take people on our public fossil digs to like a staged area where like people can dig and not worry about damaging anything important. Or maybe, you know, some people ask if we go out there and plant fossils there for people to find, which we absolutely do not do. We take people to our actual research sites, and the general public is right there with us finding these unique animals and these new species that have never been seen before and have an active role in that discovery process. And so I think that's one of the really fun parts of this program, is knowing that you're right there at the cusp of the leading edge of those discoveries.
Clint Boyd is the state paleontologist. You can find out more about what he does, the fossil record in North Dakota, at dmr.nd.gov. And you can also check up for the fossil dig this summer as well. Clint, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, a report from Harvest Public Media about a boom in home gardening. And we'll hear about the work of Food of the North. That's all coming up. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Governor Burgum is urging the Western Area Power Administration to give North Dakota utilities and their customers advanced warning if they have to temporarily shut off power, as directed by the Southwest Power Pool. The SPP has implemented rolling blackouts over its 14-state region because of skyrocketing demand for power because of the cold wave affecting the central United States.
North Dakotans deserve as much lead time as possible to prepare for rolling blackouts before their service areas are affected.
Burgum, in prepared remarks, also said SPP's actions should ensure these rolling blackouts do not have a domino effect by sidelining other energy sources on the power grid, such as gas-fired peaking plants in western North Dakota. Burgum said this event demonstrates the need for baseload plants, such as the coal-fired plants in North Dakota.
And instead of heavily subsidizing only non-dispatchable intermittent sources with tens of billions of dollars of tax breaks, the federal government should be investing more in research and innovation, such as carbon capture and sequestration, that strengthens our base load capacity to meet the needs of all Americans all the time with clean, reliable energy.
Ann Burgum said this also shows an added importance to find a buyer for the Coal Creek Station to keep it online. The state Senate has turned down a bill to make the state health officer and the human service director elected positions. Both would be on the no-party ballot. Fargo Republican Senator Kristen Roars spoke in opposition.
It was doubted that we would find qualified candidates for state health officer that would be interested in dipping their toe into the political waters.
But the sponsor, Hankinson Republican Senator Jason Heitkamp, said the health officer has a lot of power but is not directly answerable to the people of North Dakota.
The citizens are willing to give great power to individuals who listen to them and that they hold accountable through elections. North Dakota State Bill 2331 does just that.
The measure failed 44-3, and West Fargo commissioners voted to extend the city mask strategy until May 3rd. It asks the public to wear masks in public or when social distancing is not possible, but has no enforcement for noncompliance. Mayor Bernie Dardis says he's had reports, including photos, that show many bars and restaurants in West Fargo that are not complying. He called it awful.
Due to the fact that the vaccines have not been distributed in the manner of which that was first anticipated, and a lot of us, when we were looking at forward, was that, you know, we're going to have, I hate this term, but herd immunity in a very quick manner, which we're not going to have. It's going to continue to go on for months and months. So public health has requested of the city of West Fargo to continue extending this wearing of the mask.
West Fargo's mask strategy expired on Monday. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I'm Dave Thompson. On this week's Legislative Review, we'll talk with freshman Democratic Representative Zach Ista of Grand Forks. We'll talk about the session so far, how he's reacting to the unusual circumstances because of the COVID pandemic, and the issues he's watching. Legislative Review, Friday at 6:30 p.m. Central on Prairie Public's radio service, as well as on our digital platforms.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. If you've taken up gardening during the pandemic, you're not alone. COVID gardens have popped up all over the country. More people are working from home and they want to grow their own food. That's led to a huge spike in demand for seeds. And as Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin reports, seed companies are struggling to keep up.
Steve Larimore was hoping to triple the size of his garden this year near Bend, Oregon. Once his seed catalog arrived, he started to put his order together, and then he hit a snag.
Out of about 60 items I ordered, a third of them were sold out already.
Tomatoes, kale, lettuces, sweet corn, all gone. He couldn't even get a hold of his favorite zucchini, the Zucchino Rampicante.
That was one I was really looking forward to growing again because it did very well. And it's quite unusual. It gets about 2 to 3 feet long and curls up in all kinds of interesting shapes.
Home gardeners across the country are facing similar problems sourcing seeds for their spring gardens. Last year, nurseries and seed companies saw historic levels of demand, and so far, this year is no different.
The closest before COVID hit was during Y2K. Y2K was just a little blip compared to this.
Nikos Cavagna is a purchaser for Fedco Seeds based in Maine. She says since the pandemic, Fedco has hired more customer service reps, increased the number of daily worker shifts, and had to get creative to find enough seeds. Since the pandemic started, Cavagna says they typically reach their daily ordering limit within 10 minutes.
It feels to me like the gold rush, you know, and everybody's at the starting line and the gun goes off and...
But Cavagna emphasizes, while you may not be able to get your favorite seed variety, there's no overall shortage.
It's not so much the shortage of seed, but it's that we don't have the staffing to ramp up that quickly, especially in COVID.
Baker Creek Seeds, located in Missouri, is in the same situation. Right now, it's seen 5 to 6 times more demand. Its seed packing machines just can't keep up, and managers have had to bring in more human hands to help sort and package seeds. Kathy McFarland says her seed company is also constructing a 50,000-square-foot warehouse in order to expand their operations.
We are now figuring out that that 50,000-square-foot warehouse is not big enough. We're looking to expand again already before we even have that one up and running.
The spike in seed demand is causing a shortage of certain produce varieties, and that especially poses a problem for commercial farmers. They carefully plan their yearly crop based on specific factors, things like climate, irrigation needs, harvest timing, and yield. Hans Bishop helps run Prairie Earth Farm in central Illinois, where he's in charge of seed acquisition. He says this year they've had to make some adjustments, including buying different kinds of onions.
We don't know how these different varieties are going to perform. If we're trying something new, we're just going to have to wait and see if it performs the same or better or worse than what the varieties that we have, grown to trust over the years.
Bishop's strategy next year is to try hard to get in ahead of the home gardeners when ordering his seeds. Oregon gardener Steve Larimore says he's planning on saving his seeds from this year's garden and using them as bartering stock with his garden club next year. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative that looks into America's food and rural issues. And this programming note: in tomorrow's episode of Main Street Eats, Sue Balcom will offer some gardening insights. Next on Main Street, a new project from Food of the North.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, a consumer-owned generation and transmission cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with over 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
They have quite an impressive history on the largest island in Greece.
I don't think there's a prouder person to be found in Greece than a Cretan.
Learn how European blackbirds are adapting to our modern world.
They sing at a higher pitch because of the traffic noise that they have to rise above.
And hear what Mark Adams found cruising in Alaska.
Your camera comes out at dawn and doesn't go away until dusk.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The pandemic has disrupted just about everything. That includes food habits and the food supply chain. Megan Murdahl is the co-founder of Food of the North, and in a recent Prairie Pulse television show, she talked with host John Harris about pandemic challenges and a new project called Midwest Mediterranean.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. Well, thanks again for having me back on the show. It's an honor to be here today. So I am a North Dakota farm girl, grew up in northeast North Dakota, and have been spending about the last 10 years of my life in the Fargo-Moorhead community, doing education and working on a few projects, Food of the North, Little Free Garden, and the Red River Market. I'm a person that's very passionate about food, nutrition, health. I am a dietitian by trade, and I work full-time with the NDSU Foundation doing fundraising for the College of Agriculture there. So I have my hand in a lot of different pots, mm-hmm. but it all kind of coalesces around food, nutrition, agriculture, and health. So that's kind of my, I guess, my mission in life.
All right. Well, it sounds like you're busy. But you're here to talk about a sort of a new project and a book, and the book called Midwest Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that. What's the project and what's the book about?
Yeah, so it is a new project of Food of the North, which I'm really excited to be here to chat about. So Food of the North is an organization, and our mission is to celebrate, connect, and empower our local food community and beyond. And one of the ways that we do that is through a monthly event that we put on called First Fridays at B. And at First Fridays, we invite awesome people from our local food community to speak about different food and agriculture topics in our region. So a lot of those topics that we have had have focused really heavily on local food and, you know, encouraging people to think more about what is grown locally and sourced locally and produced locally. But in those conversations, we've also had discussions about how there are really amazing foods that are produced in other parts of the world that we don't want to live without, right? Things like olive oil, coffee, chocolate. And so we, about a year ago, had an event, one of our first Fridays, and the topics was global sourcing, local impact. And we had a couple presenters who talked about how they are procuring ingredients from other parts of the world and bringing them back to our community. And one of those presenters is a gentleman by the name of Peter Schultz, and he imports olive oil from Greece. And in that conversation, he was talking a lot about how the foods of the Mediterranean and this delicious cuisine that they have over there that is based in olive oil and nuts and red wine and these things. And when we talk about the Mediterranean diet, it has such a, it's very well received and well respected from a research perspective, but it's also a super delicious diet too. And so he and I started chatting about the Mediterranean diet and how people in our community and our region could really make that work, blending the aspects of that diet with the foods that are grown here. And so that was really the birth child of Midwest Mediterranean. We know that our region of the world produces so many amazing foods, and many of those fit perfectly into the Mediterranean diet. So we wanted to take what we know about the Mediterranean diet and make it specific to our region and our place, and that's how Midwest Mediterranean came to be.
Well, give us a little more, you know, so what is, of course, when you think of diet, people think, oh, I'm going to lose weight. Well, it's not what we're talking about.
No.
What is that Mediterranean diet?
Yeah, so we say Mediterranean diet because that's just kind of the common phrasing that's used, but the main thing that people are trying to say with the Mediterranean diet is that it really isn't a diet, it's a lifestyle. So as a dietitian, I have talked to so many people who hate the idea of dieting or look at dieting as a short-term fix. It's something that I'm going to do for a couple of months because I have a wedding or a place that I'm going and I want to lose weight. That is not what this is about. This is really a pattern of eating, a way of living, a way of enjoying food that you can do every day of your life. And one of the things that I like to tell people about that I so love about the Mediterranean diet is that not only is the research super solid in terms of it being nutritional and promoting heart health and all different aspects of your health, but it's also delicious. And that's what really is the distinguishing factor with the Mediterranean diet from so many others. We're not going to be living deprived and you're not going to have to be eating bland food. It's really wonderful, delicious food.
Well, that may be a good answer to what I was about to ask, is why should people in the Midwest, you know, look to the Mediterranean for a way to eat? I mean, we grew up on meat and potatoes and whatever from here. So
yeah, why? So one of the reasons the Mediterranean diet gained so much notoriety is that in the 1960s and 70s is when a lot of the population nutrition research was really starting to happen and looking at regions in the world where people had better health outcomes, where they had lower instances of heart disease, where they lived longer, healthier lives. And they discovered that the Mediterranean was one of those regions. And thinking about our population here in the upper Midwest, I'm a Midwest girl. I am proud of so many parts of what it means to be a North Dakotan. But unfortunately, we don't have great health outcomes in our place in the world. We suffer from a lot of chronic diseases, and we suffer from a lot of issues of weight and obesity and things that really are attributed to the lives that we're leading. And, you know, I grew up eating meat and potatoes, too, and hot dishes and all of those things. And unfortunately, those foods are really filled with a lot of things that aren't great for our health. So as we're moving forward and thinking about what we can do to live longer, healthier lives, which I think everybody wants to lead, we can look to a lot of the foods that we have here, but think about and that are grown here, but how they're prepared. And I think that that's one of the distinguishing factors that we get with the Mediterranean diet is the emphasis on how those foods are prepared that produces the healthiest foods as well as the most flavorful, delicious foods.
Okay. What foods are grown in our region that are part of the Mediterranean diet principles, I guess?
Yeah. So I think that when people hear Mediterranean diet, you know, immediately your mind goes to olive oil, which is an awesome part of it as well. But there are so many foods that are overlooked in the Mediterranean diet that are really key tenets of that diet. One is whole grains. I have here some oats on the table mm-hmm. that are produced by one of our contributing authors, Noreen Thomas. She's an organic farmer just north of Moorhead. And she produces these amazing oats that are super flavorful. And the Mediterranean diet has a lot of quinoa and different grains. But here in the Midwest, we grow barley, we grow wheat. And one of the things that I really like to stress as a dietitian is that grains, they get a somewhat negative reputation because a lot of the ways that we eat grains is in the processed forms, meaning that the grain is refined and processed, and it's used for flour to make things like baked goods and breads and those things. And those can still be healthy. But when we're looking at what really creates the healthiest way to enjoy grains, it's in their whole intact form, which I have some examples of here. And what that does is that the more intact the grain is, the more work the body has to do to break that grain down and digest it. It improves your glycemic levels. It keeps the body fuller. It gives you more fiber. So grains are something we produce a ton of here. Another thing that we grow in abundance in the Midwest, which is a key part of the Mediterranean diet, is beans and legumes. So that's beans, peas, chickpeas, and lentils. Between North Dakota and Minnesota, we are the top producing region of those foods in the whole country. We grow tons and tons of beans, and they are plant-based sources of protein, fiber, rich in a whole array of vitamins and minerals. So that is another key part of the Mediterranean diet and a food that we grow very well here. And the other thing I just want to say, too, about what we grow here in the upper Midwest that fits into the Mediterranean diet, it's really interesting that, you know, our place in the world, we are amongst the most richest farmland in the whole world. And in our growing months, we can produce almost anything, right? In those 4 months where the sun is shining and the days are long and the air is warm, almost anything can grow here. And what we've really excelled at in our place in the north is learning different preservation techniques for the foods that we grow through root cellars, through pickling, through fermentation and canning. And so all of those fruits and vegetables that we can produce up here in abundance in those months, taking that and then using those different preservation techniques so that we can extend those and enjoy them in the winter, that's an awesome way that we can enjoy our foods while enjoying those fruits and vegetables that are key to that Midwest Mediterranean diet.
Hmm. Well, let's step away from that a moment and talk about COVID and the impact COVID has had on the food industry. You know, restaurants have been hurt financially, obviously. But what about your organizations, the ones that, of course, you've been working with and founded?
With Food of the North, we do a lot of events typically, but like everything else, we've switched to the virtual environment. Thankfully, because so many of our farmers markets are open-air outdoor markets, most were able to be open and function last summer, and I think it's looking the same that it will be for this summer. But just in terms of what COVID has done broadly for the food industry, it's really been amazing to kind of watch this transformation that's happened from March till today. I think what we saw when COVID first started was when people were home, there was some novelty to this idea of being at home and doing a lot of home cooking. Sourdough bread baking was an absolute craze. People were pulling out their pasta makers and making all these elaborate dishes. That's kind of tempered down a little bit. Some of the things that I have seen that are trends that were already starting before COVID, but what COVID has accelerated, the first being home food delivery. You know, we saw the HelloFresh and the meal kits. Those things were already on the rise. That only increased exponentially as a result of COVID. And from everything I have read, that is here to stay. Grocery delivery, takeout delivery, home meal kits. People are going to capitalize on that convenience factor and maintain that. And then the second thing is people's interest in gardening and local foods. Garden sales, garden scene sales, people establishing first-time gardens, that hit an all-time high last summer with people's interest in creating more food security for themselves and their families. And that was a trend we were already seeing, and more people jumped on that wagon with COVID. So I think that that's something that we're going to hopefully be one of the silver linings of COVID, is that people are caring about reconnecting with their food on an even deeper level than just it's trendy to eat local. It's now something that people really, they care about their food security more than they ever did before.
You've talked a little bit about this, but can you talk about how the food supply has been impacted?
Yeah, it's been amazing to see. Well, one, I think one of the things that was most surprising to folks when COVID first happened, and it almost seems crazy to think back on how concerned we were at times in the spring and early summer about getting certain foods mm-hmm. and what we would have access to and what we wouldn't. But one of the things that COVID really showed was the fragility of our food system, particularly our national and globalized food system that is so efficient and really incredible when you look at it, but it is so vulnerable to slight glitches that can throw it off, whether that be our meat supply or a whole number of things. So in terms of what we have seen, one of the things that I think is really interesting is the response that has been made by people to try to find alternative sources to not be so reliant on that national and global food system. At the start of COVID, there was a Facebook group that emerged called North Dakota Farm to Fork or Farm to Table. And I just checked it this morning, and to date it has like 28,000 members, and it started in April at the start of COVID. And it's a place where people are sharing all the things that are they're growing locally and processing locally and making available to people locally, and then what people are looking for in that too. So people are really trying to find alternative supply chains. And I think that that's going to be a really interesting thing to watch as this continues to move forward, how this local and regional food scene evolves. And there's probably a lot of entrepreneurial opportunities out there for folks as well who are interested in creating new businesses that are providing that local food, that healthy food, as well as that local security piece as well.
Well, Megan, we are just about out of time. But going back to your book, especially if people want more information about Midwest Mediterranean, when will it be out and where can they go? Who can they contact?
Awesome. Yeah, so the book will be out this summer. We'll be getting that launched and hopefully the summer of 2021. And if you want more information on it, you can visit our website, foodofthenorth.com.
Megan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Food of the North co-founder Megan Murdahl in a conversation with Prairie Pulse host John Harris. The show airs Thursdays at 6:30 Central on our television service. Tomorrow's show will feature Diana D'Amico-Polowitz. She's the author of Blaming Teachers. Decoded 8 Book is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight,
people begin to ask themselves, what is God's plan for us?
On the Black Church.
You start to see storefront churches dotting the cities of Chicago, Detroit.
The church extends its reach.
Healthcare, job, employment.
Moving beyond the pulpit.
What do we want?
You have to include what is real.
I think we're disenchanted.
They abandoned the institution. They didn't necessarily abandon God.
The Black Church.
Watch part two of The Black Church. This is our story. This is our song, tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, on Prairie Public. Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 17th. The Bank of North Dakota is the only state-owned bank in the U.S., and is forever tied to the populist, nonpartisan league that controlled state politics a century ago. The bank's creation came during the so-called Spanish flu pandemic, which sickened state lawmakers, some of whom left their hospital beds to cast crucial votes in 1919. House Bill 18 created the bank as part of the Industrial Commission, which was created by House Bill 17. North Dakota's governor, attorney general, and agriculture commissioner make up the Industrial Commission. Both bills were part of a slate of programs pushed by the Nonpartisan League, which advocated for farmers against lenders who took advantage of them. The two bills passed the House on the narrowest majority. They came with emergency clauses, which gave the bills immediate effect upon being signed by the governor. Two representatives were absent that day, being sick in hospitals. A third was hospitalized in Bismarck with influenza, but was brought to the House to cast his vote in opposition. Cheering and applause lasted more than 10 minutes after the House passed the bank bill's emergency clause. On this date in 1919, the Senate encountered a similar scenario on the two bills. There was no clear majority to pass the emergency clauses without the vote of a senator sick in bed. The Senate conferred with the governor and the attorney general and recessed to give the senator time to get to the Capitol. The Senate voted, with the sick member there for his aye, and passed the emergency clauses on thin margins. The bill signing, days later, was a celebration. The House and Senate held a joint session. An orchestra played, "Hail, Hail, the Gang's All Here," as Governor Lynn Frazier signed a raft of bills that included the Bank of North Dakota and the Industrial Commission. There were other lawmakers who did business while sick with flu. The Speaker of the House presided over the chamber while ill, and at least one other representative left the hospital to vote on financing for the bank. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Uh-oh, the kids are stuck home? Well, there is some help. Prairie Public reminds you about PBS Kids. It's on the television, but there's also PBSKids.org, where you can find all kinds of educational and fun games and activities. PBSKids.org or PBS Kids on Prairie Public.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski was one of seven Republicans who voted to convict Donald Trump in his impeachment trial.
She's now a pariah, totally on the right, and will be. It's irreversible.
Could Alaska's new open primary save her from angry GOP voters and help her get reelected next November? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online, and after the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, Dr. Josh Ranum is the Vice President of the North Dakota Medical Association, and we'll talk about a promising treatment for COVID-19. Then Sue Balcom will join us for Main Street Eats, to talk about prepping for gardening in May. It is warming up. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.